Searching for Steady Boy. 56. It was Charlie Barnes' Appreciation Day, the first annual, which in subsequent years always fell on the Saturday closest to the anniversary of his diagnosis. A catered event with balloons and speeches, followed by cake, it took place on Harmony Drive in Oak Park. The inaugural theme, Forgive Skinnaman. As he approached 90, and especially round golden 100, the event grew more elaborate and all-purpose, thriving in direct proportion to his decline, until by some gravitational pull all its own, it detached itself from its humble origins and became the beloved local holiday it is today, between Harlem and North Oak Park Avenues on Lake Street, pink and gray, the official CBAD colors. 57. I have no really vivid memories prior to coming to live with Charlie and Charlie at the house on Vermilion Street. Only vague ones, of being lower to the ground and of moving around a lot. I recall a black-and-white selection of dead birds in a shoebox, swapping butthole odors with a much older delinquent named Kyle, and more than one humorless minder from Vermilion County Foster Care, all of whom might have been abandoned or abused in their time. With Charlie and Charlie began all things colorful. Bedtime stories, nursery rhymes, rides on horsey's knee, snowy fields before sunsets, the crunch of deadfall underfoot, pumpkin goop on newspaper during our annual carvings, and other bright and surprising developments. Charlie, squatting, catches me coming down the slide. Puckering, he judges among many donuts. Calibrating, he corrects the rearview mirror. He dims the bedroom light and says goodnight. They may have intended to adopt me. I don't know. I have two theories about that. One is that the divorce interfered, as it did with so much. And the second theory is that Charlie Prophet, discovering on the eve of delivering her second child that the man she married was not as advertised, could not bring herself to commit to yet one more bond between them, legal or otherwise, and allowed the status quo to carry the day until Florida beckoned and it all dissolved. I know none of that for a fact. I only know that one day when Marcy was a baby, they chanced to recall another baby, this one left for dead in the Fair Oaks Row House. They made inquiries and discovered that he was still living in foster care, still making the rounds, and they took me in. Then, 8 or 9 years later, when our fresh start in Florida soured, they let me go again. I must have observed enough that troubled me before the time I came to live in the house on Vermilion to always approach a new home with trepidation. This primal urge to flee only strengthened after the divorces and their sudden shocks to the sleeping arrangements, a serial misery that even an honorary member of the Barnes clan, such as I, was forced to endure over the years. The house on Vermilion Street, the house on Cudjoe Key, the balm of open Florida breezes, the cottage in the village of Downers Grove, the hot dog between the sofa cushions in the house on Rust Road. If Charlie wished to root his life in something worthwhile and meaningful before dying, I simply wished to root. But there was yet one more. The house on Harmony Drive. On the first annual Charlie Barnes Appreciation Day, I pulled up to the curb. I peered out from my rental. I immediately wanted to return to the airport. I called Charlie for encouragement. He didn't answer. That is to say, I love my dad, his children, that family, but the new house changed the dynamic. It was kind of an estate. It was perched on a sort of hill. the driveway inclined up and around, encircling a magical little copse of birch trees, those peeling, leaning sticks that appear wintry in all seasons. The picture window reflected the blue sky in monochrome and reduced the plump three-dimensional clouds to UFO wafers. Someone, a party planner perhaps? Was it possible that the one-time nurse and basement stockbroker hired party planners now? Had lined the path along the drive with shepherd's crooks, those bo-peep items from which red and blue Japanese lanterns glowed dimly in the daylight, guiding partygoers toward the house. I found all this intimidating, and I have not yet said just how fancy that house was. I recoil from such fine places when they are full of people I'm madly in love with. I loved the Barneses, all of them, almost, with the exception of one or two. I only ever wanted to be loved in return, treated like a son and brother. It was impossible. I was too anxious. Was I really welcome there? Was I wanted? What should my name be? Where did I belong? Who was I? There was also that distaste, shared by my foster siblings, for re-encountering the awkward and the alien in every new home, what for their sake might be called a step home. There was too little warmth in step homes, no feeling at ease there. No making yourself comfortable on the step furniture in the step den, and never any peace of mind when taking a shower. Someone unknown might suddenly open the door by accident. A group of them might be standing right outside, overhearing your every disgusting noise. The step toilet belonged to other butts. The shower curtain was poxed by the mold of a different clan, and the soap, a sliver of step soap, reduced to the size of a guitar pick, invariably hosted a dark hair or two that everyone took for granted should be easy to overcome now that we were all one big happy family. The instant you walk into these foster homes and step homes, you are expected to break bread with second cousins and their girlfriends, guys named Ron, people who come out of the woodwork and look pulled off a lineup. These weirdos and psychopaths get woven into your most intimate celebrations and the most vital days of the year. I would include among them all the Glamours, Dicker Dicks, and Ledeux. I did not want to get out of that car. But then I could, and did, because I recalled that Barbara and I had grown close. Barbara and I, together, had nursed him back to health. Barbara and I had hugged. I was halfway up the drive, in chinos and a sport jacket, a small gift in hand and already with a little speech, when she came out of the house dressed to the nines, affixing a final earring. She must have seen me from an upper floor window and hurried down. She broke off from this difficult accessorizing long enough to firmly, brusquely point. Away. Go back, she demanded. Back? She succeeded in pinning the earring in place just as she went past me. When I didn't follow, she turned and beckoned. Then she led me in fury down the circular drive. 58. The pages I emailed to Charlie Barnes a week earlier, the pages I ill-advisedly gave an elderly man about his youthful self before a festive occasion as a gesture of love and honor, were not yet labeled Farce or 105 Rust Road, as nothing about them was intended to be farcical. That is still the case. The words remain the same. Only the name of that section has changed. However, it was then and is now a strictly factual account of the day of his diagnosis. Was it brave of me, or just downright dumb, to give Chuck the first half of this book? It had taken me years to write, years and years, much longer than a work of make-believe might have, and included in it the true story of his parents' assignation in a cornfield and the crude wedding that followed. What is now labeled farce was and is the true and accurate retelling of a single day in a confused man's life as he faces the prospect of a deadly disease, his dreams thwarted and his delusions intact, his contradictions thriving, his children mad at him, and his debtors in hot pursuit, and zero resolution for any of it on the horizon. Barbara took the liberty to climb uninvited into my rental, a cheap compact thing completely denuded of character, and slammed the door behind her before I even had the chance to walk around the rear and get in. That she knew which car was mine confirmed my suspicion that she'd been tracking my arrival. Now, the car filled with her perfume and rage, Barbara Ledoux fixed me with one of her rare hard stares from the far corner of her seat.
"Just who the fuck do you think you are?"
I was stunned and didn't reply.
"Just when I was coming around to you, too."
"Have I done something wrong?"
"It's a shame, because you and I have something in common. You and I can see his children for who they really are. Hateful little bitches. You will never catch me saying that to him, and I will deny up and down ever saying it to you, but that is what they are. Hateful little bitches. If it wouldn't destroy Chuck, I'd want him dead. They serve no purpose, and they bring no joy. But," she said, "this book of yours—"
"Hold on," I said. "What do you know about that?"
"Takes the cake."
There was a long pause. "It's only half a book," I said. "It's unfinished, and I sent it to him, not you.
Have you read it?" "What is all this preposterous shit about a flying wig?"
It took me a moment to realize that she was referring to the Dewlander, the novelty item Chuck hoped to commercialize after his friend Happy Necker peeled off his hairpiece at a picnic 40 years earlier and used it to play fetch with a stray dog. "So I take it you've read it."
"Is that just pure invention on your part?"
"I didn't make up the Dewlander," I said. "He invented the Dewlander in the 1970s. I didn't know how else to respond. This was the same woman who had denied there was an earlier different Barbara in his life. The result, I believed at the time, of his omitting that bride from his biography. He told a forgivable little fib meant to reduce by one his total number of past wives, and that one an especially uncomfortable precursor on account of a common name. Maybe the Dewlander was another tender source of youthful folly for him, one he preferred to forget, and his wife was simply telling the only truth she knew."
"You don't seem to know the first thing about him, judging from what you wrote. You have a completely warped impression of him."
"I have the warped impression?"
"You turned him into a clown!"
"Well, Barbara, he was a clown for a time there. A lot of other things, too. I mean, that's kind of the point. He's lived a full life. He has a complicated past. He's far from perfect. A man. He's just a man."
"He is not just a man. He is the best man."
"I agree."
"And you've made him into a farce."
"There's not much I can do if the facts end up reading like a parody. Some people's lives just look like farces. That's who he was that day, by his own admission. There's nothing in there that isn't true."
"Nobody wants to hear it," she said.
"But you have written it down. Why have you written it down?"
"Everything in there is based in fact," I said. "I got it straight from him. I just listened and took notes."
"Yet it's riddled with error and completely misses his essence."
That stung. Perhaps it was true. She knew the man.
It was only fair to allow her to judge for herself. Yet I knew there were no errors and said as much.
"I beg your pardon," she said, "but he does not wear dentures."
There was a long pause. I recalled her rattling his dental plates in their plastic cup in the waiting room of Rush Memorial. "Don't be a fool," she had said to me. She personally returned those plates to his mouth.
"You're denying that?"
"I'm sorry," she said,
"but he does not have false teeth."
I knew that Barbara's capacity for denying reality was pretty robust. For years, her cool detachment toward me, her speaking about me in the third person while I looked on, her pointed and habitual lack of eye contact, and her glossing over my presence in the living room and at the dinner table helped edit me out, if you will, of the scene. She pretended I wasn't there, amended real life on a whim. But this was much bolder. This was a weird attack on the truth for reasons unknown. To save face? To defy me? I spoke slowly, clearly. "His parents never told him to brush," I said. "So his teeth rotted. He was 24 years old and in extraordinary pain when he had them pulled. The dentist's name was O'Rourke. The bill came to $350 1964. I got all that from him."
"Which one of us is his wife?" she asked. "I think his wife would know if he wore false teeth."
"If he doesn't want me telling the world that he wears dentures because he is embarrassed..."
"He doesn't want you telling the world he wears dentures because he doesn't wear them."
"But you know that he does."
"I know no such thing."
Only then did it occur to me that there was no way Charlie had withheld the Dewlander from her. The prototype still had pride of place on the bookshelf in his basement office, and 40 years after the fact, he'd not hesitate to sell the uninitiated on its pleasures. What's more, he'd learned what damage withholding does from his days with Charlie Prophet. He was a wiser man. He had delved with Barbara. It was she who denied the Dewlander, together with his other Barbara, and now the dentures, because they were facts incompatible with her idea of Charlie, inconvenient and unpalatable facts, as his ex-wives were unpalatable, and his children. She checked her earring in the mirror, then violently flipped the visor back into place before turning to me.
"You're no longer welcome at this party," she said.
"Are you speaking for him when you say that?"
"I have news for you. That's my house, and you're not welcome in it. Not today, not ever."
She opened the door and stepped out. I did the same. She turned back when I called her name. "I stuck up for you," I said. "No one else would. No one else likes you. No one can comprehend what a warm person like Charlie sees in you. Okay, you're gifted, you're disciplined, you're everything he's not, but at least he's capable of love and affection." She turned without a word and carried on up the drive. 59. Ban me from a foster home? That was no great loss to me, lady. I would be damned if I entered that house. But I would get an invitation. I would get a warm, welcoming, engraved invitation to join the man of the hour inside. Because it was his house, too. And I was his son. He loved me. It made no difference to him that I wasn't his flesh and blood. He would want me there no less than he would his real kids. I called him. I called him again. No answer either time. I suppose I was hoping just to ignore what really sucked about Barbara, like her third personing, her lack of eye contact, as well as ignore my suspicion that behind that cool exterior, which made her such a gifted clinician, there worked an almost sociopathic mind with heaps and heaps of damnation and scorn for Marcy, for Jerry, and for me. I could ignore this terrible reality no longer, nor could I remain neutral in the vain hope of family happiness. German fairy tales had nothing on the Barnes Family Chronicle in the age of Barbara Ledoux. I sided with Marcy. I tried Charlie again, on his cell phone, on his landline, sent him a text. No answer. Naturally, I tried Marcy next. Marcy was still living in Deer Park, but had flown into O'Hare for the occasion. What a strange occasion. A red balloon slowly floated over the house on Harmony Drive and up, up and away. "Are you on your way to this party or what?"
"I'm already here," she said. "I'm inside the house."
"Well," I said, "wait till you get a load of this." Pacing the sidewalk, I told her everything, including Barbara's doozy about his dentures and her disinviting me. If there was one person primed to froth at these outrages, it was my fierce and reactionary older sister. When I had finished, I asked her to find Dad and put him on the phone or send him outside so that I could explain. I planned to remind him that he had requested I tell the truth, if ever I chose to write about him. He wanted a factual account, which I had written. There was, I thought, a real long pause. "Dad?" she finally said. There was another long pause.
"Chuck,"
I said.
"Jake, did you really think it was going to go over well? All this bad stuff you wrote about Daddy?"
"What bad stuff?"
"In that book of yours."
"Hold on," I said. "How do you know about my book?"
"I've read it, Jake."
"You have? You read it?"
"Did you really need to be so..."
"You've read it. Barbara's read it. Who else has read it?"
"Descriptive?"
There was a long pause. "Descriptive?" I said.
"I don't think Daddy didn't think so much about, or have as much, the whole sex thing, Jake. You've blown that way out of proportion, haven't you?"
There was another long pause. "I hardly scratched the surface," I said.
"Daddy had a libido?"
"Your dad?"
"Yeah, Marcy. A sizable one."
She didn't immediately reply.
"So he really liked to..."
"Yes, he really liked to."
"That much?"
"According to the man himself, yes." There was another long delay.
"I wish I didn't know that," she said. "Jake."
"Yes?"
"Did Daddy really drop out of Michigan State?"
What was going on here? Did these people not know the first thing about one another? "It's a factual account, Marcy. I made nothing up."
"But it seems like you must have," she said. "What about this suggestion that he called you first?"
"Called me first?"
"On the day of his diagnosis. You claim that he called Jerry, who he believed was in Belgium. Then, on his way up the driveway after getting his newspaper, you write that he called you next and got your voicemail."
"You really did read it, Marcy. You really did."
"Would he do that, Jake? Or would he call me first?"
"Why does it matter who he called first?"
"Maybe he was simply going down his list of contacts," she said. "And because J appears before M alphabetically, he dialed you first. But in that case, he'd have called you before he called Jerry. And that's not really how Daddy works. You know what I think? I think he called me first, and then maybe he called you."
"I present his entire life story,"
I said. I give you his history, his hopes and dreams, and a sense of his character, and you get all hung up on the sequential order of a few phone calls? It's your claim that this is a factual account, Jake. Isn't that your claim?
That's my claim.
Well, it's also your claim that Daddy called Jerry first. That part kind of makes sense. Jerry's the firstborn. Hi, Jerry. I have cancer, blah, blah, blah. Give me a call. But then you claim that he calls you next. How is it that you describe yourself? Oh, that's right. His personal hope and change.
There was a long pause.
But why would he call his personal hope and change before he called me his favorite child? I think we can both agree that I'm Daddy's favorite child. And what are you again, technically, aside from being hope and change?
Okay, I said. I get the point.
No, it's important to say it, I think. If it's really a factual account, Jake, you should come out and say it.
I'm his son. There was a long pause. His foster son.
Who would he call first?
He would call you first.
So you might want to fix that, she said. In this true account of yours.
She hung up. 60. After Marcy refused to put him on the phone, I called him directly. There was no answer. I called him 2 times more. The difference between a foster kid and an orphan is this. A foster kid might have someone to call. Yet he wasn't picking up. Had I offended him with the truth? But he wanted the truth. I should not have told the truth. No one wants the truth, and no one should ever tell it. I didn't know what to expect from the first annual Charlie Barnes Appreciation Day. Brats on a backyard deck? Dunk tanks? I snuck up the side to the backyard for a quick peek, despite being banished. The caterers were the farm-to-table kind, busy in their starched whites, sautéing mushrooms and putting cold soup in shot glasses. In time, these would be passed on silver trays. The yard was dominated by 2 white tents. There were linen tablecloths and tiki torches, and a DJ was setting up near the pool. Charlie's guests began arriving. Little old ladies followed the Japanese lanterns up the driveway bearing gifts. A caterer greeted them and handed each newcomer a disposable camera from inside a wicker basket. A sudden peal of carburetor thunder concluded, with a half dozen motorcyclists pulling to the curb and dethroning. Men he must have known from Rabineau's garage. Another set of men, hired help in white jumpsuits, arrived in a branded minivan from the local bakery. They threw open the back doors and unloaded a large sheet cake, as if it were a light little love seat. Taking in this vibrant start, I thought, so much for brats on a back deck. Returning from the backyard, I skirted none other than J. Patrick Boyle, a pal of Charlie's from his clowning days. I confess to always feeling a little uneasy around J. Patrick, receiving his self-printed business cards, listening to his vaguely hostile projections of all the great things just around the bend for him in the, quote, pyrotechnic arts. It was the same prediction he'd been making half his life, and always with one hand on the same unicycle seat. He was getting his act underway when I slipped past him unnoticed. For the next hour, I watched an uncertain crowd ask itself if the juggler in buttoned vest and bowler animating the driveway was a paid performer or a fellow guest. Not everyone could say for certain as late as the drive home. Cars crowded bumper to bumper around the circular drive, then along both sides of Harmony Drive, before I noticed that Charlie had someone parking cars for him.
A skinny young lad in black jacket and bow tie taking keys at the foot of the cul-de-sac. First a party planner, now a valet. I couldn't believe it. Steady Boy was a hirer of help and a friend to moneyed types. One pulled up just then in a vintage Mercedes convertible. The driver stepped out, wearing a seersucker suit and carrying a silver trumpet. Just the trick, when the time was right, to bray the gathered into a conga line. After the valet drove off with his car, he aimed his instrument at the sky and blew. I was standing on the sidewalk in the unseasonable heat, wondering what to do next, hoping my dad would return my calls, when a man and his wife appeared with a potted orchid so red, so other, it might have been cultivated in the tropics of Andromeda. On their way by, they casually inquired, "Is this the party for Charlie Barnes?" I told them to follow the lanterns. They had started for the house again when the man turned back. "Are you his son?" Was he a distant cousin? One of the doctors who had saved his life? "The writer. Am I right?" "That's right." Who was this guy? I knew everyone in his life by then. I could recognize anyone. He stepped forward with an outstretched hand. "Bruce Crowder," he said. It was Evelyn Crowder's son, the man who had demanded his mother's money back in September of 2008. He was nothing at all like I had imagined him, the aging alpha male, peering squint-eyed at all that might be out to screw him. Nor was he some impersonal force backing Charlie into a corner on the day of his diagnosis. He was about 50, I would say, with a little gray in his hair and the eyeglasses of a biology professor. He shook my hand warmly as his clear blue eyes sought a connection with mine. I liked him immediately. His wife, too, had a ready smile that put me at ease as we said hello. I turned back to Bruce. The soft-spoken man I mistook for a bully, the guy I assumed had been a big dick to a good man, had probably only been beset by grief on that day long ago. "Boy, is your dad proud of you," he said. "He tells me you had a book on the New York Times bestseller list. Is that true?"
100 years ago, I said, repeating one of the old man's favorite phrases. "Are you working on anything at the moment?"
"An invitation to this party," I said. Bruce laughed at this in a way that made me like him even more.
"That shouldn't be too hard to come by," he said. "I can't think of anyone who's prouder of his son than your father is of you. Now tell me, Bruce, is that true?"
"Absolutely," he said. "And there's no one I respect more than your father. He looked after my mother for 23 years before she died, and now he does the same for me. He doesn't need to manage other people's money anymore. He has enough to do just managing his own. He feels it's his duty, I guess. Your father is a loyal man."
"Tell me something else, Bruce. Did you ever get the $10,000 he said he would return to you after your mom died?" Bruce looked taken aback by the question, as why should I know anything about that?
"I did."
"All 10,000? And within the time frame he promised it?"
"If not sooner," he said.
"So he's a man of his word."
"Your father?"
"Absolutely."
Bruce said he hoped to see more of me on the inside, and he and his wife carried on to the house. Had I been, as a writer, an idealist, a reformer, or just a heartless bastard, I might have told the really awful truth about Steady Boy. The naked stuff he shared only with me late at night, and only in a whisper. He disclosed these episodes and inclinations to reassure me that I was not alone in my disgustingness, that I did not need to be separated from the human fold. Oh boy,
Then you would have seen Barbara run me right off the curb and out of Oak Park forever.
Truth as true as that debases. It alienates. Ultimately, it renders us all animals. I might have gone on about the relentless fucking, the unbridgeable gap between him and greatness, his stubborn mineral selfishness, the sick thoughts, the perverse urges. I held back. I made it honest but respectable. I won't spare myself the same way. You want abject? I was mentally at the curb even in the midst of them, pestering someone to pick up, another to pay attention, a third to invite me in. They threw a good party. But old Jake knew he could always be sent back with the rented chairs. 61. The nut brown muscle car, now a bona fide classic that Jerry arrived in, fully restored on his own dime after he landed on his feet, courtesy of the old man, was a wild contrast to the unmarked white van he drove for years. It shifted my understanding of Jerry. That shift had, as its closest correlative in the material world, the clever little toy that had delighted my father as a boy whenever he dug it out of a Cracker Jack box. The 3D lenticular portrait, efficiently demonstrating with a pivot of some 20 degrees the kinetic potential of the subject at hand. The lion at rest, now roaring. The slugger squared up, now connecting with the ball. As well as the work of time. The glamour puss aging into a spinster, the pirate degrading to a skull. The pitiless fate mankind was subject to in toys of this kind had, in Jerry, been reversed, and the rag-clad bum of recent memory in denim cutoffs and stained T-shirt replaced with the smiling, suntanned executive. It was a bit of beautiful magic. He handed the keys to the valet and, with flowers in hand, began heading up the drive.
"Jerry," I cried. "Come over here. Don't go in the house just yet, Jerry. Come talk to me first."
He reversed his tracks and joined me at the curb.
"What are you doing out here, Jake?"
"Want a quick word," I said. "Hop in the car."
"What for?"
"A quick word. Hop in." I smiled at him after we shut our doors.
"Here we are," I said. "A couple of truth-tellers. Feels good to be out here, doesn't it? Away from all those phony step people."
"I'm kind of eager to get inside, actually."
"Do me a favor, would you, when you get there? Find Dad for me and ask him to come out. I'll be right here at the curb."
There was a long pause.
"Dad," he said.
"Chuck," I said.
"Charlie."
"What are you doing out here at the curb, Jake?"
Barbara objected to something I did, and now she's banished me from the house.
"Is it that book you wrote?"
There was another long pause.
"What do you know about that?"
"I'll be honest with you, Jake. I'm not sure how I feel about being one of your characters."
"Did you read it?"
He nodded.
"You read it?"
He nodded again.
"Barbara's read it," I said. "Marcy's read it, and now you've read it.
Has the old man read it?"
"I don't know," he said.
"What I do know is that it made me uncomfortable. I didn't like being one of your characters."
"You're not a character, Jerry. You're you. You're Jerry."
"You know what I mean. I'm not crazy about being in it. It depicts a time and a place I'd rather forget. You might remember, Jake, not much was going my way back then. I'm not eager for a reminder. Certainly not a permanent reminder."
"You're not going to publish that thing, are you?"
"I don't know," I said. "It's unfinished. But there's not much I can do about the past, Jerry, and how things were for you then. It's a factual account."
"Can't you take me out?" No, I can't take you out. For Christ's sake, Jerry, you're his firstborn son.
But it's his story. Who cares about a firstborn? It's not a novel, I said. It's a factual account of the day of his diagnosis.
I can't just make shit up in a factual account, Jerry. I'm obliged to mention the firstborn. And if that firstborn happened to tell him he was in Belgium on the day of his diagnosis, when in fact he was living on Western Avenue, I think that's pretty pertinent information. You were there that day. You played an important part.
He wasn't happy about that.
That was a terrible time for me, Jake. I was stuck in a rut, depressed, angry. I'm no longer that guy. Anyway, I'm a dynamic human being. There are many different sides to my personality. I play the guitar. I fly airplanes. I can code with the best. I was gainfully employed for many years running, Jake. Did you forget about that? And I don't know if you know this, but my spiritual insights are real. My Buddhism is real. Those aren't poses. But you hardly touch on any of that because you're so fixated on my goddamn dumpster diving, which I did for like 2 years at most, and my goddamn denim cutoffs. I'm not a pair of cutoffs, Jake. There's a lot more to me than smoking pot and reading Krishnamurti. But in this book of yours, half book, I said, it's unfinished. Charlie Barnes isn't the only man living out a farce. I'm a fat joke, too. One-dimensional, unchangeable, grotesque, dishonest. I wear the same clothes day after day after day. I never do laundry. I never shower. I never put on a suit and tie. I never eat a fancy meal or make love to a woman. I'm hardly the human being I know exists out here in real life. I don't want to cast aspersions on your execution here, Jake, but I'm never more than a caricature in this so-called true account of yours. And I get it. I get it. At that particular time, I was a caricature. I was little more than a ranting troll. For the left, of course, but still. Don't take me back to that time, Jake, please. Don't stick me in that time forever. The same static, strident, unhealthy motherfucker from here to eternity, ranting and raving against all of society's ills and his poor, disappointing father. Leave me out. Otherwise, you do me an injustice. I need a longer time frame and a bigger stage for my soul. Cut me out. Or how about this, Jake? Make me the hero.
The hero?
Sure, why not? You like me, don't you?
I love you, I said.
And you know how dynamic I am. You even say it yourself somewhere. I'm like a myth.
Jake, forget about Charlie. Write about me. I'll tell you everything you want to know.
But this book is about Charlie, Jerry. It's a testament to Charlie and my love for him.
Then do me the favor of leaving me out of it, Jake. Make me the hero or cut me loose, one or the other.
It suddenly occurred to me just how nice Jerry smelled. The bland rental had filled with the fleur of a lush masculine springtime on account of his French cologne. He smelled expensive. He was out of those dumb denims we both hated and in a pair of tapering white chinos and leather loafers, which he wore au courant without socks. He'd slimmed down, too. I was duly impressed. And they say people can't change. On me, at the moment, he tried a different tack.
If you can't make shit up, Jake, and everything is true, then why are there so many inaccuracies?
I suppose you're about to tell me that he doesn't wear dentures, I said.
Of course he wears dentures, he said. There's no sense in denying that.
I'm talking about that part where my mother and I go around Danville looking for him during the time of those cicadas. Do you remember that?
Sure, I remember it. I wrote it. Well, you have us driving east.
Driving east?
On Vermilion Street. But Vermilion doesn't go east-west, Jake. Vermilion goes north-south. It's a north-south street, Vermilion. So why do you have us going east-west?
That's your objection?
Then you have us passing the Palmer Bank. The Palmer Bank wasn't on Vermilion. The Palmer was downtown, Jake. It was downtown. The Palmer Bank was downtown.
There was a long pause.
You might as well have us driving through Hoopston.
Hoopston, I said.
That's right, Hoopston. Or Briscoe, or Flatiron.
Danville could be any one of those small towns for how cavalier you are with Vermilion Street.
You want out of a true account because I get my directions wrong?
Jake, this is north, south, east, and west we're talking about here. You can't just have your way with north, south, east, and west.
Take me out. Or at the very least, obscure my identity. Isn't that something you writers usually do?
Would you like me to obscure your identity?
You use my real name, for crying out loud. I can't even plausibly deny knowing you people. What if we go public someday, Jake? Or everything goes into the shitter again and I'm out there looking for another job. HR learns I'm the guy in your book, I'm fucked. Let's say I'm out to dinner, and my date discovers that I'm the dickhead in that famous book who lied to his dad about going to Belgium. Am I going on a second date? I don't think so. I'm never getting laid again. My name is plastered on practically every page.
What would you like to be called? I asked him. There was another long pause.
I've always been partial to the name Jerry, he said.
Okay, I said. Jerry it is. And I made him Jerry, just like I said I would.
I'm sorry, Jake, that's still not good enough. I don't want to be in your book, period. Take me out. If you can't get the little things right, like which way Vermilion runs, how can anyone trust you with the big stuff?
So you can effectively hate the man for years, hold all these grudges against him, lie about living in Belgium, move back in with him when you go broke and get evicted. You get all these second chances, but I'm not allowed to make a little mistake about which direction the streets run?
Sure, he said. I'm his son.
He stepped out, but before shutting the door and heading inside, he bent down for a final word.
Just out of curiosity, Jake, what did you hope to do?
Redeem him?
There was a long pause. Now that would be a work of fiction, he said.
He shut the door and walked up the drive in his leather loafers with his pretty flowers.
62.
I stepped out of my rental and resumed pacing. I tried my dad's cell again. Still no answer. A large discontinued Cadillac pulled alongside me. It was rusted along the edges and packed to the gills with old people. The driver, 100 if he was a day, was spry enough to lean over the laps of his ancient polyester-clad passengers to holler out, "Are you the valet?" I pointed behind me. The man put the car in reverse. As they retreated, I heard the voice of an old lady say,
"So there is a valet."
A second later, that same party was involved in a little fender bender with the actual valet, who was trying to parallel park a Nissan in a neighborhood now crowded with cars. Coming up the sidewalk a minute later was my uncle, Rudy, the vitamin peddler and life extension fanatic. Rudy had made his fortune on the internet, and unfortunately, the culture did not require that breed of man to dress well, if at all. Rudy had a habit of wearing high-on-the-thigh runner's shorts everywhere he went, showcasing the entirety of his long, ropey legs, no less than if he were toweling off after a shower. while pairing that garment with a traditional white Oxford shirt that hung below the skimpy shorts. Altogether, this provocatively suggested that he might be wearing nothing at all below the waist. This sort of thing made his nieces and nephews unaccountably depressed whenever we appeared in public with him. As I was not related to him by blood, I didn't mind it as much as, say, Marcy did, although it's true that Rudy was my least favorite Barnes. It was his opinion that my books were unreadable. According to Rudy, they were full of unlikable characters. Every one was either a dick, a cynic, a moral bankrupt, or a scumbag who gave the human race a bad name. Well, here you are, Rudy, a minor player in one of those books. How do you like the characters now? He did not come solo. He was pushing down the paved, mellow path Delwina Barnes in her 95th year. A cane crossed over the arms of her wheelchair, and the old lady's arms crossed over the cane. Tall, white, and listing, she resembled a wheeled Tower of Pisa. I, like you, had assumed that Delwina was dead. She was not dead. Diabetic and demented, but not yet immobile, by God, there she was, a monument to gerontology ready to party. I was attempting to slip inside my rental unseen when Rudy spotted me. He knocked hard on my passenger side window, then a second time, which forced me to lower it.
"I don't sell dog pills," he said.
"Beg your pardon?"
"You have me selling dog pills in that book of yours. I don't sell dog pills."
Narcissism, justly lamented for doing so much damage, especially within the family unit, could also work miracles, as when a fundamentally apathetic collection of illiterates gets wind that they appear as characters in a book and transforms overnight into a bunch of rabbinical scholars. First Barbara, then Marcy, then Jerry, and now Rudy. Animals in the wild were more likely to read something I'd written prior to my turn toward the biographical, but now it appeared I'd never lack for readership. Is there anyone in this family who hasn't read my book?
I run a respectable online distribution center of high-end dietary supplements and herbal remedies. Everything I sell gets my personal seal of approval. I sure as shit don't peddle dog hormones or whatever the hell.
It's unfinished, by the way.
What do I care if it's unfinished? A slander's a slander, son.
I'm sure it's just a misunderstanding, Uncle Rudy, rather than an intentional slander.
Do not call me your uncle, he said. You know, from the moment Charlie told me that you might tell the story of how our parents met, I thought to myself, we've got the wrong guy. My mother is a likable person. We are all likable people. This is a wonderful family. Ask anyone. But then you come along and give us your take on things, and there's only one word for it. Unlikable. You don't really do likable, do you, Jake? You do quirky sometimes, you do dysfunctional. You do weird, diseased, mentally ill. You do ugly and unpleasant. You do varieties of the damned. We didn't stand a chance from the beginning. And now look. Sure enough, the decency is gone. The charm is gone. We are completely unlikable. It's a crying shame. But I'll tell you what, son. Change that shit about dog pills, or I'll see you in court.
As we were talking, the natural grade of the sidewalk set Grandma Dell gently in motion. Rudy hurried over to the old lady, caught her before she really took off, and hauled her up the drive. 63. After that, I thought, fuck it. I'll go inside and find Charlie myself. for one of the accommodations he had made to his compromised life was to guarantee to his children that wherever he might find himself, the door would be open to them, and I was his child. Wasn't I his child? I might have barged right in, too, and demanded an answer to that question had it not been for a new surge of arrivals. Among them was that decorated veteran and member of an elite force, Barbara's son and my stepbrother, Troy Ledeux. Crisply buff, blindingly white, a buzz cut, with military cap in hand, he seemed to want to mind his own business. But as he turned at the sidewalk to take the drive, his starched gleam, so bright and martial against the backdrop of a slumbering suburb, drew stares, and patriarchs broke off from their humble family units for the honor of shaking his hand. I stayed put. At 6 years old, after screaming Saddam Hussein, Troy wailed me in the nuts, and now they tingled at the sight of him. Talking to his fans in the circular drive, he spotted me at the curb. He excused himself and walked over to have a word. "Interesting book you've written," he said. "You've read it too?" "But it made me curious," he said. "What about his time in the service?" "Beg your pardon?" "His two tours. You don't even mention them." "His two tours?" "From 63 to 65, he said. "He served two tours, or so he's always told me." There was a long pause. "Steady boy in Vietnam?" "He said this to you." "More than once." "And he wasn't joking?" "These were man-to-man talks," he said. "He was dead serious every time. So it has to be one or the other. Is he a veteran? Or a bald-faced liar and fraud?" I didn't really know how to answer that. I did my best. "He was present at the launch of Apollo 11, I said. "I know that much." "Do you?" he asked. "Or is that just another story he likes to tell?" With that, he turned and walked up the drive. 64. After watching from the curb as Troy entered the house, I had a simple epiphany that reframed my reality and aligned it more closely with the consensus view. In the step house on Harmony Drive, step people like Dr. Barbara Barnes and her Blue Star son were the real and substantial people, and I was the step person. I was something even grubbier. The foster kid with the stunted arm, related by blood to no one, a hanger-on from a nowhere town. I deserved to be kicked to the curb. I think I loved Charlie because I, too, could feel terrible self-pity. If no one respected that about him, least of all Charlie himself, it gave me the secret feeling that he and I really were father and son, with more in common than he had with either Jerry or Marcy, both of whom could be so hard on him. Charlie spoke so little of his own father, and he was the more neglected and damaged of his mother's two sons. I think he could feel like an abandoned child himself, closer in spirit to the stray mutt than his well-nourished little brother. He saw himself in me. We had similarly squalid starts, and we had physical defects, my arm, his teeth. I loved him, and he loved me. Had I done something impertinent then? By heeding his directive that should I ever write about him, I should write the truth? Real life makes for good novels because it's lived as a bunch of lies, and because fictions of one kind or another are the only things worth living for. That didn't mean that a man of great pride and ambition cared to be reduced to his carnal acts, misallocated resources, and impotent rage. He was a clown in my retelling, and something worse than the real thing. The metaphorical clown that men become in the eyes of other men when their dreams flop, and some dickhead with a bullhorn is there to broadcast it, disclosing all his insecurities and failures to the world. He must be furious with me, I thought. I'd betrayed him. What sort of surrogate son repays the man who made all the difference with public humiliation? I tried him again. No answer. What happened next was a lifesaver, even a kind of miracle after the passage of so much time. Sunk down in the discoloring gloom of my unbelonging, feeling as faint as the light flickering from those Japanese lanterns, I was sitting in the car when I noticed a man and his wife making a steady advance in my side mirror. They were proof of former times. It was my father's old friend, Happy Necker, given name Julius, the bald, bounding, good-humored, unwitting inventor of, and early investor in, the original Dulander. Beside him was his wife, the woman I had called Aunt Wyla, as far back as I could recall. Trotting alongside them was a shaggy, black-matted mutt that had to be so old by then that it was its own sort of miracle. So much more real, more elemental was this Danville couple than those extras and specters arriving with them that I immediately hopped out of the car as if to cure myself completely of step-personhood with the mutual warmth that would pass between us at first sight, such as, Uncle Happy? Why, Jake Barnes! So good to see you. And do you remember? Of course. You were my Aunt Wyla. Indeed I was, and still am. Come over here, kid, and give me a hug. And like that, enfolded in her arms again, reminded of picnics on warm blankets, wool hats in winter, and animal tracks in the snow, and of Leanne, their only child, my first crush. All the loot stolen from the galleon ship of my childhood when Charlie and Charlie divorced might have been buried within these two old treasure chests, whose sudden reappearance restored at once all that had been lost. I had missed them without knowing it, the way a middle-aged man observing a child at play will suddenly apprehend how much paradise has crumbled away since he was that age. And as we approached one another on the sidewalk, I put my hand out with only a smile to speak my thoughts. But the man said nothing, just frowned and shook his head in confusion as he slid past. The woman fell in line behind him. The dog marched on. Neighborhood strangers out for a stroll. They gawked up at the lively party in progress, turned at the corner and disappeared. Julius Necker died in Palm Springs in 1999. And if that dog had been the one I dumbly mistook it for, the mutt that caught Happy's toupee at Kickapoo State Park, in dog years it would have been 240 years old. 65. When all at once, I recalled Karen. We were over an hour into the party by then. The flurry of traffic had died down, and now it was just me and the valet kid idling around each other near the curb. I watched him pull a sandwich from his front pocket and consume it, except for the crusts, which he returned to his pocket. 10 minutes later, a barbershop quartet arrived on foot in matching silver vests and straw hats and marched up the drive. Strains of their harmonizing soon drifted out to us. I didn't like asking Karen for favors, or putting myself at her mercy. Mercy, I mean. I never wanted to be at Karen's mercy. I recently claimed that Rudy was my least favorite Barnes, but that was true only if you didn't take into account Marcy. I keep calling her Marcy. Forgive me. It gets confusing, even for me. There is Marcy, of course, my older sister, or foster sister, who lives in Deer Park, Texas, the one who
Well, you know Marcy. Then there is Karen, our younger sister. That is Marcy's full sister, Jerry's half-sister, and the second of my foster sisters, whom I haven't mentioned as much. Karen is the second and final child born to Charlie and Charlie. How baroque the Barnes clan is when you really delve. I had hoped to smooth a lot of this out, spare the reader these blended family confusions, the arch genealogies and branching family trees, by taking some of the customary liberties of a true account, like a memoir, in this instance, presenting two people as one and calling that hybrid creature Marcy. In that spirit, I sometimes made Marcy a little meaner than she might have normally been, with a fouler mouth, having blended in a bit of Karen. For efficiency's sake, I was hoping to keep Karen out entirely, but then the old man wasn't picking up, Marcy refused to put him on the line, and Jerry was mad about Vermilion Street. Karen answered on the first ring. "What's up, Flip?" Karen called me Flip. "Hey," I said, "can you find Dad for me and..." "Dad," she said, "can you find Chuck for me and, hey, where am I in this book of yours?" "Hold on," I said. "You're reading it too, Karen? Really? You?" "I know, hard to believe, right? I don't usually read books. Good books, sure, but not stupid bullshit books like the kind you usually write." "Thank you," I said. "That's very encouraging. I hear you're calling it a factual account, but it's the funniest thing, Jake. I can't seem to find myself in it anywhere." "It's unfinished," I said, "and it was really only meant for Chuck. Jerry's in there. Marcy's in there. Even Darge LeDeux gets a little cameo. But Karen Barnes has gone completely missing." "Not completely.
I flicker in and out of this fucking thing like a hologram," she cried. "You've effectively erased me from my own fucking life."
"What are you calling it, Jake? The sun also lies?" "Do you have any idea how hard it is to write a book?" I asked her. "You have to make a million decisions, be absolutely ruthless. Inevitably, certain things end up on the cutting room floor."
"An entire daughter?"
"If you don't like my account, you can always go write your own."
"Oh, sure. Let me just whip up a book real fast." "I don't know how to write a book, Flip. I didn't go to some stupid, pointless writer's workshop like you did."
"I know it's a lot to throw at you here at the 11th hour, the fact of Karen. I know it's a lot to process. I probably should have involved her more from the very beginning. She could be abrasive, is all. Vindictive, unyielding, and cruel. I'm pretty sure she hated me. She would have preferred a childhood that did not have me in it. For the record, any curse that issued from Marcy's mouth in this account very likely came from Karen's."
"If only I could write a book, Flip," she continued. "I'd tell the whole world what a creepy fucking kid you were, and what a furtive little thing you are now."
"Okay, what do you want, Karen? Want to be the hero like Jerry? Should I make you suffer from cancer too? How about I make you his only daughter? Better yet, his only child. Why don't I call it the Book of Karen?"
"No, none of that," she said. "But it would be nice if you said a thing or two about the time you punched me. Remember that, Flip? Sure, I held you down, but you punched me, hard as you could, with your one good arm, right when I wasn't looking. Who does that? Who cold cocks a little girl?"
"I don't remember that," I said.
"Oh, sure you don't," she said. "Listen, you want to know what I think? I think you cut me out of this little book of yours because that's how you've always wanted it. You've never wanted to share Charlie Barnes with the rest of us any more than Barbara has. But I feel the need to remind you, I am the blood relative here. I'm an actual biological child. While you, my friend, You are a little leech with nowhere better to be. Please find Chuck for me and put him on the line. I was with you in that bathtub in the house on Vermilion Street, playing with those toys when she goosed him. I was with you on the front staircase when he showed up with $200 from the Palmer Bank. And I was with you on New Year's Eve when we watched The Champ and everybody cried and we drank sparkling cider. How could you leave me out of all that? You were with us the night we watched The Champ. I was 7 years old. It was New Year's Eve. Where else would I have been?
I'm sorry, Karen. I honestly don't remember you being there that night.
I am the reason he drove back to Danville every weekend, she said. Not you. You were included, but only because you had to be. He came back for me. You just happened to be there.
I don't believe that, I said.
You think he would have made that drive for a foster kid? The very same kid he forgot about when you were living on the streets in Key West?
He didn't forget about me. He was broke. He was getting back on his feet in Chicago.
Right. Keep telling yourself that. Besides, I ran away. He didn't forget about me. He sure as hell knew where Marcy was. He knew where I was. He didn't know where you were until you got arrested and he had to take you in. He didn't have to take me in. He wanted to take me in.
Uh-huh, she said.
Because it just wouldn't be a family without Jake Barnes, would it, Flip? You know what? Give us a second and we'll all join you down at the curb.
She hung up. 66. In one of my earlier books, a character quotes frequently from Ralph Waldo Emerson, but here, I do so as myself. It often appears in a family as if all the qualities of the progenitors were potted in several jars, some ruling quality in each son or daughter of the house. And sometimes the unmixed temperament, the rank unmitigated elixir, the family vice, is drawn off in a separate individual, and the others are proportionally relieved. Karen was our rank unmitigated elixir. She did more than hold me down. She spat on my face. She called me names. 30 years later, she was still calling me names. Perhaps I did punch her once when I was 11, but only a glancing blow and only after she had strangled my hamster. Now as an adult, she shut me out of family games, excluded me from get-togethers. Everything had to be all about her. Her money-making schemes were like Charlie's, only intentionally criminal. Her inventions were debasing and cruel. She angled. She conspired. She lurked around bedrooms for jewelry and passwords. You could never trust her with your mail. You could never invite her to crash for the night. She brought ruin everywhere she went. If she dated a politician, he went to jail. If she was seeing a Russian, he ended up dead. She was hollow, too, a moral vacuum. She prayed and read the Bible and wore a cross at her neck, but it was all just another frightening tactic. She had the mentality of a born mobster, and my aversion to her was so profound, my hands trembled in her presence. They were trembling when she ended our call. It may seem disingenuous at this late date, but part of me just hoped to spare the reader our Karen. And the other part of me, well, it's true, I guess, what she said. That part of me just wanted him all to myself. I crashed the party after that. I had no choice. I was a wreck. He wasn't calling me back. He always called. He loved a phone call. There was nothing the man loved more, and to talk to him meant the world to me. It meant I had the ground beneath my feet. Without his voice on the other end, I was in free fall. I had to take my chances. With or without an invitation, Barbara be damned. It seemed that my unfinished book had done what not even pancreatic cancer had managed to achieve. It had united the Ledeux and the Barneses. But I still had not heard a word from the man himself. I walked up the circular drive and around the house to the backyard. As befitted that fine house, the yard was expansive, well-groomed and tiered. A taste of manor life I hadn't seen since my time in the Cotswolds with the McEwans. Oh, who am I kidding? I don't hang out with the McEwans in the Cotswolds. But I have seen pictures of their place online, and this was not unlike that. The acre of backyard was more like a meadow, brightly ringed by late-blooming gardens. Just beyond that began the local forest preserve, an ancient remnant of hickories, hopsedge, and fern, populated by owls, muskrats, elk, yes, even elk, and many other becalming woodland creatures. This rustic reminder, forming the far border of the yard, could make you forget you were in the suburbs. The pool and bathhouse were off to my right, in what was once an empty lot. You might think it was evening. It wasn't. The water glittered gorgeously, like cut diamonds. The absolute centerpiece of this wonderland, however, was the cherrywood gazebo. Old men and new mothers chatted there, denim butts leaning against the banisters. Nearer the house itself, there was an ivy-laced pergola, where dappled sunlight fell over still more of the gathered. They milled under the tents, too, and occupied the many little tables. Slices of cake had joined the past hors d'oeuvres and flutes of champagne. I stood off to the side, taking it all in. I looked around for my dad. He was, by then, keen on pleated peach trousers, a collared shirt, white suede shoes, and a gold herringbone chain, plus the charcoal heather cap for his head, but saw no sign of him. Someone walking by me was devouring a shish kebab with both hands. He fluttered three fingers in hello. The many children in attendance had found one another by then and were running around in little packs. One kid was dressed as a ballerina, another in his taekwondo uniform, a third as a princess in halter top and tiara. And as I watched them and their friends and enemies take sides, plop down on the grass, wrap their arms around one another and lift with all their might, leap from the tree swing and dart off in all directions, only to reassemble a minute later to gossip and conspire, I was reminded of how little I thought of their adult counterparts. Grown-ups comprise the ultimate secret society, to which is automatically admitted every liar, cheat, and scumbag, and yet to whom is owed, perversely, unaccountably, the respect and submission of every single child out there. Great souls, in their childish guise, are the temporary slaves of sadists and misers, and the only way they have of freeing themselves is to become grown-ups themselves, no doubt diminishing, dimming, damning those souls in the process. I was sorry for what was about to hit those kids. The dawning of adulthood, that rude awakening into the longest-running hypocrisy in human affairs. And there was nothing I could do to soften the blow but urge them from afar to keep playing. Play until you are no longer free. I flung myself off the sidelines and into the crowd. I said hello to those I knew and introduced myself to those I didn't. I came first upon Barbara's sister, Darge, still in her Christmas sweater, discharging her nervous tic, and talking to Frank Santa Croce, the grocer's son, Charlie's oldest pal in the world. In every crowd, there is always that one lefty who eagerly throws his hand out before he catches on, and I'm forced to take it and to shake it the only way I can, watching half amused as his mortification at my birth defect blooms. That crowd included old title insurance salesman, desk traders and stockbrokers from his Dean Witter and Bear Stearns days, and fellow members of the Danville High Dramatics Club, all old now and enjoying a kind of reunion. The Johnarts were there, as were their rivals, the Mossers, members of the dueling shoe dynasties of Danville, Illinois. I didn't expect to see Evangeline, and sadly, I did not. But I did glimpse in the far distance Charlie's first wife, Sue Starter, together with her new husband, Marshall Giacone. Noreen, Charlie's cousin from L.A., came up to me to explain that one of the people who left a message for Charlie during his short-lived stint in Hollywood was Marion Doherty, the casting agent who discovered Al Pacino and Warren Beatty. A woman carrying an ostrich hide purse informed me that my dad looked great even in a bicocket. Some old Red Mask players had come up from Danville for the occasion. In homage to Charlie, they were dressed as popular types from the era of his reign, so that in among the contemporary guests, you would suddenly find yourself face to face with the housewife in bell-bottom blue jeans, the wheelchair-bound war vet with shaggy hair, and the horn dog pitcher for the Danville Keggers who, in pinstripes and sideburns, made beer spit fly from a pull-tab can. Delwina Barnes poked me in the arm with her cane as I was making my way toward the house. She was on her feet and taller than I remembered.
"I will have you know, young man," she said, "that Charlie's father and I did not meet in a cornfield. We met in the pews of the Church of the Nazarene."
I was eager to get away. Swiveling around to the first available person, I found myself standing before Stan Butkus, the Danville coach with the fused spine, and Dr. Paul O'Rourke, the Danville dentist who pulled out all of Charlie's teeth. There must have been 200 years on Earth between them. I didn't know either well enough to greet them by name, but I nodded, and they nodded, and I moved on again. I made it to the big back deck, where a clown was making balloon animals for the kids. Long before it was my turn, he handed me a pink dachshund. I admired its taut twists and plump limbs. "Say, what's your name?" I asked him.
"Name's Jolly Charlie,"
he cried, giving his red nose a honk. The kids loved it. "No," I whispered, "your real name." Out of the corner of his mouth, he told me it was Carl Wabanski, that he was the man out of Moline and that he did it all. The bunny out of the hat, the magic penny behind the ear. Then he slipped me a business card without anyone being the wiser. It read, "Carl Wabanski, the clown in your town, trademark, Moline, Illinois." I stood on the deck a moment and took in that party, the whole resounding significance of the day. Off in the distance, near the giant oak, I caught two freckled schoolboys in shirt sleeves flying the Dewlander. Not the original model or the Moonlander Dewlander from 79, but the catch-and-toss version with the super-stick grip. They were having a grand old time. Someone nudged me on the arm. It was Sue Starter.
"Jake, I had the pleasure of reading that book you wrote. I found a lot to admire. It's true, I was young once, and a ravishing beauty. But I can assure you that while Charlie was smooching floozies in the back seat of his Newport, Marshall and I were not carrying on."
"Oh, leave the boy alone, Mother," Marshall said. "It was 45 years ago. Who cares?"
We conversed amiably enough until it came time for me to brave the step house. On my way in, I ran into Larry Stovall. "If we're being honest," he said to me, "I never liked him." He was leaving with my biological mother, who was drunk, of course. She was hanging all over the Deacon of Oakbrook. She didn't even say hello. As far as I knew, she was my only living relative. Inside the house, the caterers were cleaning up in the kitchen. I went past them and down the hall. There were streamers in every room, abandoned slices of cake. I worried I was too late. He was too big, too popular. He wouldn't even recognize me. No wonder he wasn't picking up. He was a long-term survivor of pancreatic cancer. That alone warranted local news stories and viral fame. Add to that the sudden swank estate in Oak Park, the internet fortune, the doctor wife, and the natural charisma unleashed at last, now that he was free to no longer give a damn. He had named a day after himself. I still hadn't seen any sign of him when I arrived at the front room that overlooked the street. I planted my knees on the olive green love seat and peered out the picture window. After a while, a car went by, but it wasn't his. I could hear her voice from behind me, coming in loud and clear from 100 years ago.
He's never going to show.
He is going to show.
I was married to him, Jake. I should know.
Well, he's my dad, so I should know even better than you.
Suit yourself.
But you're letting a perfectly good day go to waste. I wondered where Karen was. I thought if I found Karen and we waited for him together, he would show that much faster. So I got off the love seat to look for her. But then it came to me. I knew where he was. Of course I did. It was a no-brainer. I found the stairs to the basement in that step house, and sure enough, he was down there having a little nap. It was his superpower and a natural wonder of the world, the impossible circumstances under which Steady Boy could drop off for 20 minutes and wake refreshed. I might have let him go on sleeping had it not been for the extraordinary number of guests in his house. I hovered over him, gently nudging. "Hey, Pop," I said.
"Dad."
He came too. He looked brittle, as one does after a nap. Slits for eyes, and in the eyes, confusion. It took him a moment. He sat up, cleared his throat, then he smiled.
"What a nap," he said. "Jake, what a nap. I love a good nap. Before the nap, life's hell on earth. After, by God, there's nothing you can't do."
"Don't you want to join your guests?"
"Nope, I do not," he said. "I want to be right where I am, doing what I'm doing."
"Are you mad at me?"
"Mad at you? Son, why would I be mad at you?"
"I tried calling," I said. "You didn't pick up. You always pick up."
"Hard to pick up when you're conked out."
I nodded. I was relieved. I knew all this in my heart, but it was nice to hear him say it. I realized he was in the old recliner, which had been consigned to the basement. It didn't suit the fancy house vibe. It was joined there by his roller chair and letter opener, his TV tray and its array of remotes and his newspaper, ever near at hand. He had reconstructed the entirety of the house on Rust Road right here in the basement of the house on Harmony Drive. "So you can take the man out of Rust Road," I said, "but you can't take Rust Road." I might have finished the formula, but I discovered in that instant the true cause of his deep and satisfying sleep. My half a book. It had snatched lucidity from him no less swiftly than a Western Civ textbook had 40 years earlier, or the Gita during his chemo days. What other Barneses had rapidly consumed, making a list of grievances along the way, was hard for him to get into, and the printout had fallen to the floor, where it fanned out in the direction of the TV. The few pages he did manage to finish were in a neat little stack on the arm of the recliner face down. I turned them over. He had made it to page 11.
"I'm awfully sorry, Jake," he said, acknowledging his failure. "I've been sneaking away all afternoon trying to crack it. But you know me. I get 2 pages in. Literally, the next thing I know, I'm coming to and wondering what year it is. What year is it, son?"
I told him what year it was, where he was, and all that had happened. He seemed genuinely delighted. "Now you don't have to read it," I said, "which is probably all for the best. It's made a few people mad."
"How come?"
"I tell the truth, sort of."
"Thank God for that, Jake," he cried. "There's nothing I hate more than these goddamn unlikely scenarios you fancy writers are always springing on regular folks like me. By God, write about real things, or don't write at all. It's important to focus on what matters in life, am I right? It's important to be real. For instance," he said, and finding himself getting all worked up, he thundered down the footrest and sat up straight. "For instance, why not a man in his basement, who has hopes and dreams and fears and debts and regrets and a car in need of repair and a whole lot of other things? But no, we get long dream sequences and improbable circumstances and fantastical episodes and just a lot of crap, if you ask me. No, you have to write the truth, Jake, no matter who it might piss off. I just have one request."
"What's that?"
"That name," he cried. "That goddamn name I've hated since the beginning of time."
"Do you mean—"
"Don't say it, Jake. You know how much I hate it. Listen, I don't object to the facts. You've done a damn fine job. I did marry too young. I did divorce too often. And I told my share of lies, too. I made a hash of things, son, and I was embarrassed by my teeth. It's all true. But shouldn't that allow us to take a liberty or two? I'm just asking for a tweak here, Jake. And look, I have a ready-made alternative for you. Guy I used to work with at Sears called me this one day, and I've never forgotten it. Friend of mine on the sales floor. I've probably told you this story 100 times. But back then, you see, I had a real bad temper. Things didn't always go my way, and I'd get mad. I'd go around frustrated. I'd just fly right off the handle. So one day, this guy, he says to me, he says, 'Charlie, when people make you mad, I never seen anything like it.' He used to call me Steady Boy, like what you'd say to a great stallion that's about to rear up and let loose. Okay, Steady Boy. Like that. Like I was a real live wire. I didn't mind that one bit. Made me feel feared, respected, a man to reckon with, all that. I loved it. Nothing could stop Steady Boy. Steady Boy will go far. He comes out of the gate and makes himself known. The man called Steady Boy will never die. How could he?" "What do you say, Jake?" he asked me. "Do you like it as much as I do? Does Steady Boy work for you?"